We've been talking about church finances. We talked about how Christianity at its core is foundationally a sacrificial relationship that we have with God and with each other. We talked about how that sacrificial relationship plays into the notion of meeting the needs that exist in a particular place. And we talked about the means by which the church in the first century met their needs. We started looking in the book of Acts at how the church in Jerusalem set about to meet its needs internally. Then we looked at some financial considerations that arise beyond the ability of a congregation to meet the needs internally, even when people are willing to sacrificially do what they can to meet those needs. Sometimes we need to look beyond the borders of a particular local congregation. And so we talked about the situation in the first century that arose where there was a famine in Judea, and the churches that were in Judea didn't have the ability to meet the need of the congregation in Judea. So churches throughout the world then responded so that they could meet those needs. As we looked at this, I'm impressed that the approach that they took was to identify the need and then sacrificially meet that need. I don't see the church anywhere in the New Testament building a surplus just for the sake of building a surplus. I don't know if you follow higher education at all, but many of the Ivy League schools, particularly Harvard, has this huge endowment. It's almost as if they have so much money that they have to look for ways to spend it. The church never functioned that way. It never built up a surplus and then had to look for a way to spend that surplus. It was always a matter of identifying a need, and then the church sacrificially meeting that need. And if there was no need, then there wouldn't be sacrificial giving. Now, we talked a little bit about the idea of budgeting. You know, we have some needs that are continuous. We have to pay a bill every month so we can have lights and electricity, so we can have air conditioning, but we don't have air conditioning right now. We have ongoing needs. So in that sense, there is a constant need. Needs can be reasonably anticipated. You know, we had to anticipate that the air conditioner was going to break down and that we would have to replace it. That has a 10, 12 year life expectancy. So you set aside some money so that when it comes time to replace it, you have the money. You're not building a surplus. You're identifying a need, and you're making it possible to meet that need in the easiest possible way. Now, when you've set aside money that you're going to spend to re-roof the building or replace the air conditioner or see to security, and you have to buy cameras and do some things to help with security around the building, sometimes you have been setting aside money for 5 years in your budget that you're going to spend to re-roof the building, and something happens. There's a flood. There's a famine. And you might have to redirect those funds that you had set aside. You'd budgeted them for that purpose. That's what people were giving to support. And then you say, we've got this money set aside, let's divert it, and let's use it for this other need that arose that's immediate, and we need to respond very quickly. You're still not building a surplus. You're just recognizing that the needs that you were giving to suddenly were supplanted by some other needs that arose that you couldn't anticipate. And so sometimes that's what we have to do. Now, tonight I'd like to turn our attention to the difference between individual and collective financial responsibilities. I think we all understand that we as individuals have a relationship with God that is not dependent upon the relationship that we have with anybody else. We also have a relationship with other people who also have a relationship with God. So as an individual, I have some responsibilities financially. As a member of a collective or a member of a church, I also have some responsibilities. So let's just look at the difference that we can see between the ways that we discharge those financial responsibilities. 1 Timothy, the 5th chapter, a very long reading. It begins in verse 2, and it continues all the way down through verse 16. Can I get somebody at home to read from 1 Timothy, the 5th chapter? You're really almost reading about half of that chapter. Chapter 15, beginning at verse 2, down through verse 16.
I can.
Okay.
The older women as mothers and the younger women as sisters in all purity, honor widows who are widows indeed. But if any widow has children or grandchildren, they must first learn to practice piety in regard to their own family and to make some return to their parents, for this is acceptable in the sight of God. Now see who is a widow indeed and who has been left alone, has fixed her hope on God and continues in entreaties and prayers night and day. But she who gives herself to wanton pleasures is dead even while she lives. Prescribe these things as well so that you may be above reproach. But if anyone does not provide for his own, and especially for those of his household, he has denied the faith and is worse than an unbeliever. A widow is to be put on the list only if she is not less than 60 years old, having been the wife of one man, having a reputation for good works, and if she has brought up children, if she has shown hospitality to strangers, if she has washed the saints' feet, if she has assisted those in distress, and if she has devoted herself to good works, but refuse to put young widows on the list, for we, when we feel sensual desires in disregard to Christ, they want to get married, thus incurring condemnation because they have set aside their previous pledge. At the same time, they also learn to be idle as they go around from house to house, and not merely idle, but also gossips and busybodies talking about things not proper to mention. Therefore, I want younger widows to get married, bear children, keep house, and give the enemy no occasion for reproach. For some have already turned aside to follow Satan. If a woman who is a believer has dependent widow, she must assist them, as the church must not be burdened, so that it may assist those who are widows indeed.
Thank you. So the point is that there were some widows that were in the church where Timothy was, The Apostle Paul says, I want you to enroll them in the number. Now, exactly what that means, I'm not sure, but I get the impression that when they were enrolled in the number, they would be cared for like the widows in Acts, the sixth chapter. Somehow a continuous effort to take care of those widows, who were widows indeed, and he gives certain qualifications for them, and he also makes the point that if you have these widows in your family, you ought to discharge a financial responsibility to them and not put it on to the church. So that there's a difference between the way that an individual discharges responsibility and the way that the church discharges responsibility. Anybody have any questions at this point? Yeah, go ahead.
A question. Oh, go ahead.
In third world countries, to the largest extent, see people living in tribes who, when their parents and their grandparents can't care for themselves anymore or they're too poor, they all live in one home together. They have an extended family. And it's the natural way that things work. And this is kind of the way it should be, I think. And I think to a large extent in this time it was.
And that's a good point. Bill is just making the point that in many cultures, we care for our elderly. And generally speaking, we care for our elderly by taking them into our homes and taking care of them. Now, that's not the only way that we could do it. When Kim's mom was a widow and we were trying to help her, we wanted her to move into our house with us, and she didn't want to do that. She wanted to continue to live in her house. And so we did our best to support her in her home. And that was a good way to do it. Eventually it got to the point where we could not support her in her home, and she had to move into an assisted living facility. We still helped to support her in that assisted living facility. And yeah.
I'm sorry, but I don't think we're recording.
Ah, thank you. Let me see.
Recording in progress.
Thank you. So we were discharging the responsibility. We weren't necessarily doing it in our home, but we were discharging the responsibility. There were, in the days when Jesus was here, certain Jews who said, I can't support my parents. The money that I have that I would have supported my parents with, it's Corban, or it's devoted to the temple. I can't spend it to support my parents. That's a mistaken notion. And Jesus, of course, doesn't allow that to happen. He says, that's just the commandments of men. That's not what God ever said. Other comments? Good point. Good point.
I was just going to ask Anne which version from which she's reading. I have King James, and it was saying, but if a widow have children or nephews, and hers reads children or grandchildren. And I'm trying to figure out how they get grandchildren out of nephews, or, you know, when they translate it.
New American Standard.
New American, okay.
Yeah, that word for nephew is a really broad term. And probably, from what I can discover, the better translation would be grandchildren.
Okay,
but
well, that makes more sense. Really?
And it does say, suggest that if my my mother's sister, who's not my mother, she's my mother's sister, she's not in my line, if she needed help, I should step up and help her as well. Right, right. When there is no ability to support her, it's not reasonable for me to say, well, I would support her, but the church can do it.
Okay, thank you.
So, you know, we could talk for a long time about the qualifications for these widows. What do you do with a woman who's 59 years old? She's not 60. She's definitely in need. Can you care for her? Probably, but you shouldn't enroll her in the number. So I don't know what that means, enroll her in the number. But we could care for anyone who had need. That's not to say that we can't care for a widow if she's 59. We most certainly could. We might not, like I say, enroll her in the number. I don't know exactly what that means, but that was a special sense in which they cared for her.
Dean, that probably means to put her, if you have one or two or three widows, then she's enrolled in that congregation of widows. That makes sense.
Yeah. And you know, there were churches in the past who said, we have eight widows among us. And this happened a lot at the end of the Civil War when a lot of men were killed. The total population of the United States was dramatically reduced when you had the Civil War. And it wasn't just young men that were being killed. It was older men as well. And churches found themselves in a position where they had eight or ten widows in a particular congregation, and sometimes they would move them all into one house so that they could take care of them that way. And, you know, it doesn't make sense to have eight houses that you're trying to maintain. You can move them all into one house. You can maintain them in that one house. Other thoughts or comments? So then there is also the statement in James, the first chapter. So let's turn and look at James 1 and specifically the statement that's made in James 1 at verse 22. Can somebody at home read that for us?
But be ye doers of the word and not hearers only, deceiving your own selves.
That's not the passage that I wanted. I wrote the wrong passage. I wanted verse 27. Can you read that one?
You want me to read it, Dean?
Sure, go ahead.
Pure and undefiled religion in the sight of our God and Father is this, to visit orphans and widows in their distress and to keep oneself unstained by the world.
Notice that this is instruction that's given to individuals. We need to exercise ourselves to support orphans and widows. And that doesn't have anything to do with whether or not they're in the church. Well, we have a special responsibility to those that are in the church, but we also have to be aware of orphans and widows. And I am convinced that with the end of Roe v. Wade, that there will be a number of young women who are going to have children who are going to need care. And it's up to us to find a way to support those women. Because they're not, we don't want them to abort the babies. We didn't want them to abort the babies before, but they aborted the babies. They didn't need that kind of care. Now, I believe that there are going to be more children born to mothers who don't have an ability to support them, and we're going to have to step up. We're going to have to really exercise ourselves to take care of those folks. So look around you. Yeah, go ahead.
I was just going to say, I apologize. Yeah. I read that verse 27 all the way through, and then I heard Ann said, you want me to read it? I had muted myself again. Sorry about that. I was just reading up a storm.
That's okay, Carolyn. If that's the worst thing you ever do, that's not so bad. I really believe that we need to be attuned to this, and we need to keep our eyes open, and we need to watch it, because this is going to be an indictment of people who didn't want mothers who couldn't support children to abort them if we don't step up and help when they can't afford to support their children. So let's just be aware of it. Now, other comments, questions? When you read something like this and you start thinking about the individual responsibility and the church's responsibility, it raises a question. If I, as an individual, choose to support someone that the church could support, if I, as an individual, choose to support a preacher who's preaching in a difficult place. Maybe he's preaching in the Philippines and doesn't have a means to support himself. Maybe he's in a place where it's very dangerous. And I am aware of that. I could choose to help in that situation without diminishing what the church does in supporting the preaching of the gospel. And there, now, if, let me back up for just a minute. If the goal of the church was to raise a surplus, and I wasn't helping to raise the surplus because I was diverting my money to another need, I could see that there would be an argument there. But the church never just tries to build a surplus. And because it doesn't try to build a surplus, if I have money that is not spoken for in the need that exists in the local congregation where I am, I might choose to use that money to support another need. So even though the church could do it, the church could support a preacher, they may choose not to. Yeah, go ahead, Bill.
There's something that's, I heard more about it back in the 60s and 70s, but that if we support a good work on our own, that we may be getting the glory from that, and it's better if we do it through the church, so God gets the glory.
Okay. And there is an argument that is to be made there. But we're never doing it to obtain glory for ourselves. See, that's what short circuits that argument. We're not doing it to obtain glory for ourselves. And the church doesn't do what it does to obtain glory for itself. It does what it does to meet the needs so that God gets the glory, not the local church. Now, this raises another question. Who controls the money? This is what it boils down to. Many years ago, when they started doing wildcat drilling in the state of Texas, and other states as well, but Oklahoma, states where landowners owned the mineral rights on the land that they owned, there were people who became incredibly wealthy because they found oil on their property. And it's like they had a surplus of money and they didn't know what to do with it. Sometimes they were reluctant to give up control of that money and put it into a collective treasury. They wanted to maintain the control of that money. Sometimes it was because, well, remember we talked about the Sand Creek affair in Restoration History? Sometimes they were afraid that if they put it into the common treasury, it could be diverted to a cause that they didn't want to support, that they felt like they couldn't support. And so they would set up a foundation or some kind of a vehicle that would allow them to contribute money from that foundation to causes that they agreed with. And some of this has to do with the tax laws and all of that. But there was a feeling, and it's a feeling that we have to explore, that if I put the money in the common treasury, it's not mine anymore. I don't have any say in how that money is spent. Yes, I have a say in being willing to support the need, but these people had more money than they had needs. And so there was one foundation that was established, and it was established specifically for the purpose of making loans to small congregations so that they could build a church building and they would have a building that they could worship in. Now, what happens when I contribute to the need that exists in the local church and I put my money into the common treasury? Well, I see a lot of information in Acts, the fifth chapter, verses 3 and 4. This is the case of Ananias and Sapphira. Ananias and Sapphira were faced with a need in a local church there in Jerusalem. They had some property, and they decided to sell that property and donate at least a portion of the proceeds from the sale of that property to the common need that existed in the church in Jerusalem. Now, there were other people that did the same thing. Ananias and Sapphira's problem was they wanted the glory for themselves. And so they said, we sold the property, we're going to give the money to the common need, and they didn't. They only gave a part of it. Acts, the fifth chapter, Peter confronts them with what they've done. And he makes some I think, really interesting statements here in Acts 5, verses 3 and 4. Can we get somebody at home to read that?
But Peter said, Ananias, why has Satan filled thine heart to lie to the Holy Ghost and to keep back part of the price of the land? Whilst it remained, was it not thine own? And after it was sold, was it not thine own power? In thine own power, why hast thou conceived this thing in thine heart? Thou hast lied unto men, not lied unto men, but unto God.
Okay. So Peter's statement is, when you had the land, you didn't have to sell the land. Once you sold the land, the money that were the proceeds from the sale of that land, that was yours. You controlled it. You could decide what to do with it. But once it's given into the common treasury, Peter wouldn't say you still have that control. Does that make sense? At least that's the way I see it. Once I put the money into the common treasury to meet the common need, then it's no longer my money. I don't get to have a say. I do have a say in whether or not I choose to help sacrificially meet the need that's been identified. But once I put it into the common treasury, that's where it goes. So I can't say, I'll put my money in the common treasury and I want it to go to support dying. Yeah, Bill.
That is one of the reasons that trustworthy elders are a necessity of the church, because it's put in their control.
Okay. That they... And Bill has made the point that that's why we need trustworthy elders. Good point. I would say that's why we need trustworthy deacons. Because it wasn't the elders who decided how to distribute that money in the church in Jerusalem. It was the people that we commonly refer to as deacons. Remember, the apostles said, look ye out from among yourselves seven men of good report, full of the Holy Spirit, that we may appoint over this business. So it wasn't the apostles that did this. It wasn't the elders, if there were elders at that time, that did this. It was those guys that they looked out from among themselves and put in charge of this business. Just like here, we have set aside Dean Anderson to take care of the physical maintenance of the building. So that the air conditioner blew up, Dean is the person that is taking care of it. The PA system doesn't work. Ted is the guy that we go to. The copying system doesn't work. Jerry is the guy that we go to. He's the one that takes care of it. Bob takes care of the physical grounds around the building. Okay? We put them in charge of doing that, and sometimes to do that, they have to spend funds. Okay? That's not what the elders do, in my mind. The elders are not the people that micromanage the way that we spend the funds. The elders identify needs, perhaps, and then they look for somebody that they can appoint to be in charge of taking care of that. But I know the point you're making. You still need good people to be in charge of managing those funds.
Well, the requirements for deacons are very much the same as elders.
That's true.
And, you know, part of that is our trust.
That's true. Good point. there's very little difference in the qualification for the elder and the qualification for a deacon. And we've talked about that some. We would talk about that more. I do think that the elders have a spiritual responsibility, and they oversee what is done to protect the flock spiritually. That's, I think, the biblical description. I don't think they're the ones that are the money managers. That's probably the deacons that do that job.
Dean?
Yeah.
I have a little bit of a problem with this, looking at surplus and accumulating the surplus. I'm supposed to give with a grateful heart. I'm supposed to give of my means. I suppose the only reason that I wouldn't give the percentage that I agreed to in my heart would be if the congregation was overburdened with so much money that maybe I had to figure out a way how to do something different. But I still feel that the congregation could have figured that out better than I. So,
well, that's a possibility. If you identify a need as a collective body and you say we want to meet this need, then it's a matter of people saying, yes, I'll meet that need. And like you say, if the need is identified, you might say, you know, the money that I had set aside that I had decided I was going to use to meet the needs, I can increase that. Which is that principle of sacrificial giving.
Yeah, but I think, Dean, there's also a problem, though, with somebody sitting there and surmising that, well, I don't need to give as much because all of the needs of the congregation are being handled. I don't see that in the scripture. I see giving as a heart thing and as a predetermined thing.
Okay. There's a lot of value to that. It is something that we determine within ourselves how we're going to do that. So you're right. It is a matter of an individual and his relationship with himself and his relationship with God. Of course, it depends there. But it's in every case that I see it described in the New Testament, it's always within the context of meeting needs. Even the statement in 1 Corinthians 16, 1 and 2, that God loves a cheerful giver, that was within the context of the church in Corinth helping with the famine in Judea. Now, there are always going to be needs. That's absolutely true. And sometimes we have to figure out whether it's something we need or we want. You know, I would like to have individual bucket seats to sit in. And individual air conditioning units right there in front of me so I can control the air conditioner just like I do in my car. Kim and I would fight over the air conditioner. She wants to turn it up. I want to turn it down. I want individual controls. That's something we need? Probably not. Is it something that we would like to have? Yeah, but it's probably not a need. I mean, I'd like to have a big screen behind me and be really neat to have that and think of the things we could do. Wouldn't it be neat to have a video studio here in the building so we could do all kinds of cool things on Zoom? Is it something we need? Probably not. It's probably something we'd like to have. Now, please don't misunderstand. I'm not saying that we don't have a responsibility to meet needs sacrificially. We do. It's just that the need comes first in my mind. And we need to identify those needs. We need to be aware of those needs. And sometimes there are people who need help and we overlook it. And we should never do that. We should be attuned to people who have need. Now, the collective took care of distributing the money that had been given to meet the need in the best possible way. So the collective, through the deacons, that's my take on this, the collective, through the deacons that were in charge of doing this, determined how those funds would be distributed. The deacons never took control of the funds. By control, I mean they couldn't spend it at their whim. It's just like the thing that bothers me so much about contributing to political campaigns is I contribute to a political campaign because I want to see a person elected. That person then takes my money and says, oh, this is my money to spend however I want to spend it. No, it's not. If you don't spend it on the political campaign, you don't get to keep it. Give it back. Because you never had control. You were given the money. It was to be spent in a specific way. And if you're not going to spend it that way, I'm not going to give the money. Okay? So the funds are distributed according to need. Even the funds that came from other churches, those funds were laid at the feet of the apostles. And then those funds, if it's like what happened in Acts 6, those funds were given to the deacon who was in charge of making sure that this happened, and that person distributed the funds. The apostles didn't divert themselves from the ministry of the word and prayer. They just passed it on to the deacons. The deacon didn't have the ability to decide how to spend the money. The collective might say, we've set aside money that Bob is going to use to take care of the parking lot because we have to reseal it. And if you don't do that, the parking lot falls apart and all of that kind of thing. And Bob can't decide on his own, I'm not going to spend it on that. I'm going to spend it on something else. It's not like it's earmarked, but that's where we put the funds. And Bob, as an administrator of those funds, doesn't have the ability to change how he's going to spend those funds. And that's what happened with a lot of sponsoring church agreements, where in the 1950s, and we'll talk about that when we continue our discussion of the Restoration Movement, the control of funds passed from individual congregations to a separate board of directors, not associated with the congregation, who then administered the funds as if those funds were their own. And that never takes place. I don't ever see that picture in the New Testament. Paul took the money from Corinth. He was entrusted with that money to get it to Jerusalem, but he couldn't decide, no, I think the problem is worse in Galatia. So I think I'll take the money to Galatia instead. He didn't have that ability. And I went over time. I'm sorry.